To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. This is Aaron Carnes, the host of this podcast. After 4.5 years of weekly episodes, we are ready to stop creating In Defense of Ska. The podcast was meant to be a promotional push for my book In Defense of Ska, and it wound up taking on a life of its own. While Adam and I both love what we've accomplished with this podcast, we both feel compelled to focus our creative output elsewhere. The episodes we recorded remain evergreen, and we invite you to explore our back catalog, which will remain online thanks to the Consequence Podcast Network. I am working diligently on a new book, a novel called Little Black Book of Death. It's not ska-related, but it has a strong musical component. I also have a punk-themed script in the works. Adam is working on new music for Omnigon. We invite you to follow our respective projects and look forward to what the future holds. To keep in touch with my writing, follow me on Substack. That's aaroncarnes.substack.com. You can follow Omnigon on their social media accounts. Thank you.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Today we talk with Ceci Bastida from the band Tijuana No, one of the most important ska punk bands from Mexico. Tijuana No formed in Tijuana, Mexico in 1989. Though there had been ska in Mexico for a while, Maldita Vecindad were the most popular group in the 80s to mix ska with their music. An official ska movement happened in Mexico in the 90s. Tijuana No both predated this Mex ska movement and were part of it. Their 1992 ska song, Pobre de Ti, was a very popular song. They also recorded a popular cover of The Clash's song, Spanish Bombs. Tijuana No were also one of the few 90s Mexican ska bands that tried to break into the U.S. market during the 90s mainstream ska boom. Their politically minded, Spanish language, eclectic ska-leaning songs weren't quite a fit for that scene. But they did well in Mexico, and they remain an important band. Ceci Bastida joined the group when she was still a teenager, and she left sometime in the mid-90s. She went on to play with pop star Julieta Venegas, and then later started a solo career. Her latest album, Everything Taken Away, was released in October 2023. It's excellent. Go listen to it right now. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis of the bands Omnigon and Lingady.
I really like that on the podcast we've been having a lot more artists from Mexico. I feel like it's an important part of the ska scene that needs more light shined on it.
Yeah, we've done some great episodes where we highlight certain eras or certain scenes, but there's so many to talk about that, you know, there's so many more episodes we can do. And like, I think much of the scene has revolved around Mexico City. So this one with Ceci is interesting because her and her band come from Tijuana. So it tells a totally different story that kind of goes parallel to what was happening in Mexico City.
Yeah. Tijuana is the only part of Mexico I've ever been to.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I don't think it gives a really good representation of like Mexico as a whole. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I had fun. I was a teenager.
Oh, you didn't play any shows in Tijuana?
No, I've never played a show in Tijuana, but I'd love to.
Okay. Yeah, you better do that. I think the thing I really like about this interview with Ceci is that she has gone on to play very different music, not just from ska, but from compared to a lot of the other guests that we've had that have a ska past.
Yeah, I really like her new album. I think it's really interesting pop music.
Mm-hmm. And she played with Julieta Venegas, as I said earlier, but I don't know if people grasp how big Julieta is if they're not in Mexico or listening to music from Mexico. She is massive. Mm-hmm. And she also played in Tijuana Nov briefly too. So that's an interesting little ska fact.
Yeah, 16 million listeners on Spotify. And to give you some context, Gwen Stefani has 16.9 million listeners on Spotify.
Yeah, so let's get Julieta at Coachella next year.
Hell yeah. And I think the more that we dig into the global impact of ska, the more we get to tell these interesting stories and talk to people like Ceci, who have very interesting perspectives worth hearing.
One of the things that came up while I was doing my research is I saw the cover that you did of Institutionalized with Lucidio.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to talk about that because I thought it was a pretty amazing cover, actually. So this was 2018. You guys did this?
I think that's right. Yeah.
They're a band from LA, and I think there's like two original members of Suicidal Tendencies in that group.
I think there's two. I'm not sure. So it's Luigi, who's the guy that I know, and who decided to do this Suicidal thing, like a mix of his name and Suicidal.
So your friends, and he just tapped you, said you should do this.
Yeah, I didn't really know him. I knew of him, and I had friends that knew him. So through them, he reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to do it. And at first I was hesitant because I was like, I didn't know how to translate a song like that, especially because it's such a famous song. I didn't want to mess it up.
Uh-huh.
But he was just very cool and chill and said, just like be a little free and experiment if you have to. But that was fun. And recording it was another thing because he was like asking me to yell it a lot. And I ended up like with a worse sore throat afterwards. It was intense, but it was fun.
Estaba en mi cuarto, viendo las paredes, pensando en todo, pero al mismo tiempo pensando en nada. Y de pronto mi papá entra y ni siquiera sabía que estaba ahí y me llamó por mi nombre.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought about when I was listening to it and watching the music video is that I had read a lot of interviews that you had done, and in reference to Tijuana No, you would say stuff like, I was the least punk member of the group, or I always was bringing in. So, but you executed lead vocals on this iconic punk song so well. So
thank you.
I don't know if you were the least punk member of Tijuana No after watching that video.
That's really funny. I mean, I definitely felt like I was outside of my comfort zone. I'm not going to lie. And even with the video, he's like, you know, you're going to be my daughter. I was like, really? It's like, I'm old enough to not live with my parents. But he's like, just pretend. And I thought he did such great acting. And I'm just very self-conscious because multiple people have said to me that I'm terrible at acting. So I was very uncomfortable. But it ended up looking good. It was fun. And he had all his friends come by when we did the performance outdoors and all of his friends with all these amazing cars. It was a lot of fun.
Whose decision was it to say Coca instead of Pepsi? Was that your decision?
I think he suggested it, said like, let's try to just change it a little bit. I mean, it wasn't like a huge change, but it's so iconic, the Pepsi. And I felt it was weird with the Coca, but we wanted to not have it be like exactly. And so that was one thing that we felt could make it a little bit different, which is kind of ridiculous because it's just one word.
Yeah, I know. That was just one thing that it's totally ridiculous, but it's one thing that popped out at me. I was like, she didn't say Pepsi.
Yeah. Huh.
Does Pepsi get called Coca in Mexico?
No, it's Pepsi. Same thing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we dive into the Tijuana No history, I want to talk about your new record, Everything Taken Away, which was released October 2023, right?
Right.
Yeah, this is a great record. And there's a few things about it, especially compared to your other solo records. Like sonically, it kind of has a, I don't know if I'm using the right word, but it sounds a little different to me sonically. It sounds like kind of more sparse in a way, kind of a bouncier, a little bit more hip hop sounding than your other stuff.
On my first record, I worked with a producer on two songs, and his name's Alex Epton. He's based in New York, and he did a lot of work with, he first got sort of well known because he started this project or this band called Spank Rock. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
Yeah.
And it's very hip hop heavy, and he's a great programmer and he's a drummer. And so we worked on a couple of songs for the first album. And then for the second album, we worked a little bit more again. And then I kind of always felt like, to me, he was musically very much what I wanted to collaborate with, like somebody like him. And so when it was time to do this last record, I reached out to him and asked him if he wanted to work on most of it with me. And he agreed. And so this was the first time that we did it in person. Before, we were just doing it like long distance. So we met for the first time for this album, even though we technically worked together since 2009. And I mean, we've met before once, but this is the first time we're actually together. And it was a great experience. But yes, this one was a little bit more experimental in the sense that it was very much plug-in. There wasn't, I don't think there was really many instruments that were played live. So I think that's also part of it.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of how it sounds. It has like, it kind of, you're like, you're leaning into that more digital sound but it sounds really creative in how you're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's also very musical. So it's not just that he's great at programming beats, et cetera, but he's very great with layers and textures, and he has like a great pair of ears, and he's like very focused on trying to get the right sound. And he's one of those people that would sit for hours with a synthesizer and until he got it in his head right. And I really admire people like that. I don't have that patience, but he's very good at it. So yeah, it was a little bit more, I guess there were less things on it. But I also kind of wanted to do it a little bit different. And each album, I think, has some differences. So we ended up doing it mostly electronic. I agree with your description of it.
What's the story with the intro track?
So the intro track is something, so basically the record was very much inspired by migration and displacement. And I've written about migration in the past. And in this case, it was so focused on it because a lot of it has to do with the fact that I trained to become a child advocate for immigrant children. This is like 5 years ago. And I started working with children directly that were either came to the border by themselves or were separated at the border, and they ended up in shelters or foster care, et cetera. And so I was very deep in that theme. So it ended up becoming this thing throughout the record. And I also, in 2018, moved for a little less than a year to Berlin. And when I was there, you meet people that have gotten to Germany from different countries. Germany was helping a lot of people from Syria or accepting a lot of asylum seekers or refugees. And so I was very interested in migration, not just US-Mexico border, but also Europe and in relation with Africa and Middle East. So I wanted some children talking. And so I was looking for just children talking or laughing or something. And I found this clip of these children, and I'm not exactly sure if they're Palestinian or Jordanian. I don't remember because this little interlude, I recorded it a couple of years ago and I just had it. So they're basically just talking, and then they say, "How are you?" And I like that phrase because I thought the album was not critical of the world today, but questioning a lot of it. And sometimes we tend to sort of look away from these huge injustices and problems, et cetera. And so this, to me in my head, this kid was saying, how are you doing? Like, basically, are you looking at me? And how is your life? So I ended up using that phrase a lot and kind of connected it to the second song and then brought it back towards the end. And it's sort of like a reminder of like, you know, this was happening and how are you doing? Like, how is your life? So I'm not sure if that makes any sense in my explanation, but I kind of wanted to make it sort of an album that was all somehow connected.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, this is probably going to come up in the whole interview because it's been a theme of your music in general, and that has to do with immigration and issues around immigration. But that was part of what inspired this record. But I'm curious your take about things, because things seem, what's the word I'm looking for? The issue of immigration seems to be at the forefront globally in all sorts of ways, in a way maybe it either wasn't before or more out in the open it is now. I'm curious your take on that.
I don't think that there's more displaced people now than there ever were.
Really?
Yes. And that has to do with many reasons. And in Latin America, there's a lot of, obviously, poverty, violence. In Central America, there's a lot of violence. There's a huge gap between the people that have money and the people that have access to nothing or barely anything. So the need to come to the U.S., I fully understand it and respect it. And the other thing that I try to remind people when they're like, you know, why are people coming here? Is that, you know, the U.S. had such a presence in Latin America. If we go back to even the 70s, which was not really that long ago, and they were interfering in these countries and supporting dictatorships that benefited the U.S. and benefited financially the U.S. So the U.S. made a lot of money from places like Argentina, Chile, El Salvador. And so when people question why people are coming, it's not because they just want to come. It's because their countries became what they are now, a lot of it because of U.S. Foreign policy.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Then you add the element of global warming, climate change, et cetera. And when you think about places or countries like in Africa, where there's, you know, you can't have crops grow, or like, you know, like there's flooding and there's no rain or whatever. And so people are going to end up moving to where they can go and have a life that they can give to their families and children, where they can survive. So there's so many reasons why people move or people are displaced or have to leave. But I know that people don't want to, like people don't choose to just go. And like, ideally, you know, if my country, my circumstances are different, but I would love to be able to live in Mexico also. Right. And just feel like I have everything that I need there. And my situation is one of privilege, but imagine coming from a country where you don't have access to schools, where you don't have access to good food, you know, nutrition. And you are, you know, in a country that has gangs or violence or drug trafficking or human trafficking. So as a parent that I am now, and I've obviously felt this before I was a parent, but you want to protect your children. So leaving for me is an act of bravery. And that's why I wanted this album to be sort of an homage to them, because I do believe that it's not easy to leave your country and leave with your family. And you know, the journey through Mexico is a very dangerous one. And the fact that you're willing to do that, it's because you're desperate.
Is there any song that you can point to on this record where you feel like really, I don't know, if captured the theme of this record, or that really feels like addresses this in a overt way?
Yeah, there's a couple. There's one that's called Dale, that basically is saying, and it's playful in a weird way, but it just says like, I've been training to do this journey, to take on this, to make this trip to a border. And I'm prepared, and I know how to move, and I know how to hide, and I know how to protect myself. And then there's another song called No Tengas Miedo, which is basically like a parent talking to the child that they leave behind, saying, you know, don't believe what everybody says. I'm strong and I can do this, and I'll basically come back.
Wow. My favorite song is, Captor?
Yes. Thank you.
What can you say about that song?
So that song is basically, it's from the point of view of an immigration officer. And so he's basically saying, I'm going to be your how do you say that word? Captor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, even if you think you're outsmarting me, I'm behind you and I'm going to find you. So that's the repeated phrase is like, te encontraré, I'm going to find you. And it says as if whenever I hear movement, I go and find you. So it's about searching. And you see this when you see images or read about, you know, the journey crossing deserts, for example, in the US, and how dangerous it is on so many levels, not just because the terrain, the extreme heat in some cases, extreme cold in other cases, but then you have all these people that are waiting for you to just make the quote unquote wrong move and they're just going to get you. So it's a song about that.
I mean, it is interesting that the rhetoric, the anti-immigrant rhetoric, is really amped up so much.
Yeah.
What it is that people are afraid of, sometimes it just escapes me. I mean, I know they're being fed fear, but I almost just don't understand the degree to which they feel controlled by this fear of immigrants, of people coming to this country that are looking for a better life.
It's almost cartoonish the way politicians describe this quote unquote invasion. It's almost like a ridiculous movie that people truly believe. They're coming at you. They're vermin. They're here to, they're rapists. They're this, they're that. And people believe these things and are genuinely scared. And we know now from many studies that immigrant communities are least likely to commit crimes. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter. Like, people are still very much afraid. So I'm like, I'm with you.
Yeah. I mean, Trump has said a lot of terrible things and it's hard to remember, but That was the main beginning opening thing. That's where he got his audience, was through anti-immigrant rhetoric. That was it. That's how he became a star.
Yeah. And when we heard him speak and say those words when he was coming down that stupid escalator to say that he was running, it was just, when I heard those things about being rapists and criminals, I thought naively, like, oh, this, you know, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
This is too insane. And I was completely wrong, because that's exactly what people think. And they held on to it and just are with him no matter what.
Yeah. I think we all thought that, oh, he's done.
Yeah.
And then
he's never done. It's crazy. Like the Access Hollywood. I was like, oh, that's it. Yep. It's done. And nope, there's ways around it.
I don't know if it's naive on our part, Adam and I's part, where, because we've lived in California pretty much our whole life. I mean, California has a history of some pretty heinous anti-immigrant stuff too.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I don't know that we're dominated by that like maybe we were in the past. But I think other parts of the country is pretty, pretty horrendous when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah. It's scary. And California does have a lot of, it's funny because you think about California as like this state that is liberal, and it's really not. I mean, there is, and it is fairly liberal compared to others, but there's still chunks of areas where it's like, if you drive north, you see like Trump, and you're like, hey, yeah, it's weird.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
There's a question, actually. I'll jump to it. I was going to ask you this question because it happens in 1994. I was going to ask your perspective on it while you were in the band, but I'll just ask it now. 1994 is when Pete Wilson, Governor Pete Wilson, has a Prop 187. And it's a really bad, like, anti-immigrant, law. And I'm just curious what your take on that was as someone who was living in Mexico at the time, if it was something that you guys were aware of, if you guys were upset about it, because up here, you know, we were upset about it. I remember seeing Voodoo Gold Skulls, and they were like, they were talking shit about it on stage, and they're like, this next song, you know, they have a song called La Migra.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, funny.
It's on their first or second record. This song's dedicated to Pete Wilson, you know, and 187. They're flipping him off on stage. You know, that was the attitude, you know, up here, even, well, amongst, you know, punks and whatnot. But I'm curious, like, were you guys aware of it down there?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we lived in Tijuana, so we were very close to, and we were very much aware of what was happening on the other side. I don't know how people in Mexico City, for example, thought about it, if they were as informed as we were. But it was a big deal. There's a video that I had left the band already, and they made this video for the song called Stolen at Gunpoint with Tijuana No, I mean.
Yeah.
And that had Kid Frost in it. And the video, it's just like, it's so stupid. But there's a character that's like Pete Wilson, basically.
Yeah.
And he's being kidnapped, which is awful. But that was sort of the band's response to this Prog 187. We were definitely aware of it for sure.
Oh, and for people, for context, I don't know if people outside of California are aware of what this was, but yeah, basically it was saying like, if you're not documented, you could be rejected for all public anything, you know, you can't be, you know, a hospital could turn you away, etc. And not only was it messed up on its surface, it also, the next level of fucked up that it was that it was like, people who were brown skinned, who were born and raised here, were suddenly felt like they were being scrutinized as being undocumented as well. So,
yeah,
that was 187 for you.
Yes.
So go back to like, I think was it early 90s. You joined Tijuana No. You were 15 years old.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, I knew some of the guys, but not a lot because they were older than I was. Because I was a kid, but they knew that I played piano. Well, one of them knew that I played piano, the drummer, and he asked me if I wanted to come and like jam with them.
Well, what was the state of the band at that point? Were they just starting? Or?
No, it didn't exist. So I started. We all started it together.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, and so we were just like getting together and like playing around and playing covers and whatever. But it wasn't thought of as like, oh, this is going to become a band. It was just like for fun. And then there were many people that came in, came out. And then all of a sudden, like, we started doing shows. And we had the name. And then we started playing. But at the same time, I was so young. And I don't know if it was a combination of being young and, like, not knowing what was up. But I never thought of it as, like, oh, I hope we record an album and then we tour. Like, that was not in my head ever. So things started happening in a very organic way. So that's how it started. We all started playing together, just kind of jamming.
What was your awareness of the music scene down in Tijuana at that point? Or were you not really connected to that yet?
I was a little bit. In Tijuana, I mean, there were a few bands that I knew of. And because I had some friends that were slightly older than I was. So I knew, but I wasn't really going out to shows because I was really young. But it was kind of a small scene at the time. And so once we started playing, I got to, you know, we got to share the stage with most bands from Tijuana.
What were the bands at that time?
God, there was a band, but this was a newer, like a little later than us, called Mexican Jumping Frijoles. There was a band called Mercado Negro, which was a punk band. And there are some others I cannot remember. But there were a few. This is a long time ago.
Sure.
So the first record comes out in like 91. I think you guys self-release it first before BMG picks it up?
Something like that. So basically there was like a competition or like a contest, a band contest from bands from San Diego against Tijuana bands, which is
really,
yeah, it was very silly. So there was like a metal band from Tijuana against a metal band from San Diego. And then, you know, and I can't even remember who we were playing against, but we won the whole thing. And we got like a $5,000 check, which we were like, oh my God. Yeah. And we ended up using it to record a cassette at a studio. And once we did that, there was like this independent label in Mexico City that wanted to release it. So they ended up releasing it. And then BMG bought that.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this first record called No,
mm-hmm.
It's pretty It's pretty all over the place.
Yeah.
Stylistically. I was listening to it in its entirety last night.
Oh, God, really?
And yeah, no.
When was the last time you listened to it, Cece?
Oh, my God. No, it's been forever. I mean, I just don't listen to it. I feel like, you're talking about like 91, right? We recorded in 90. We're talking about 30 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
More than 30 years ago. So there's things that I didn't even love then that now I'm like, oh, I would have done so differently. But yes, it is all over the place for sure.
Yeah.
I know you've talked in the past about The Clash being a pretty mm-hmm. big influence on you personally and the band. I'm curious about the ska elements. You know, what was the band's ska influences to create some of these songs?
We were listening to a lot of Selector specials. Madness, what else? Bob Marley, and you know, he kind of started with ska. I don't remember what else, but we listened to a bunch of ska, but it was mostly like English ska.
Yeah.
So we were kind of influenced by that. But for me, the Clash, because I've always kind of felt like I felt weird making music that was 100% ska, or 100 like pure ska or pure reggae. It just felt like it wasn't us. And so I wanted a mix of things. At least that was my what I wanted, right? And so The Clash to me was a great example of a band that was mixing all these things, but at the same time having a very unique sound.
Yeah.
And but songs that you could sing to, you know, you could sing with, sing along to. They were melodic, but at the same time political at times. So they had, to me, the best combination of everything. And that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be like them or like Mano Negra. But I didn't want to do like, I didn't want to be like another Selector.
Yeah.
Because it felt not authentic, really.
So it's interesting because in the mid-90s, you see a bunch of bands in Mexico, mostly Mexico City, that come out playing like, you know, ska punk or ska whatever. Panteón Rococo, Inspector from Monterrey, Sectacor. So it's kind of a boom of like the ska movement.
Yeah.
But before that, people kind of point to Maldita Vecindad as being sort of the first band to really popularize ska songs in Mexico. So I always kind of think of Tijuana No as sort of in between in a way. And also you're not in Mexico City. So I've always kind of wondered about that. Like what was Tijuana No's place in this sort of, because ska becomes extraordinarily popular and it remains really popular in Mexico.
It does. Yeah. I think when we started, Maldita Vecindad and us, we started sort of like almost at the same time, but we obviously did not have the internet and TV and all of it was very centralized. So whatever was happening in Mexico City, you didn't really know about unless they came to your town and vice versa. And so what happened is, I don't even remember how this happened, but Maldita Vecindad came to Tijuana and they did a small tour with us in three different cities. And that's how our relationship started with them. But yeah, I to me, Maldita was a band that was also doing things in a very interesting way, where they were not 100% ska, not 100% reggae, but they had their own sound. And I thought that second record of theirs was great. And it took them everywhere. People loved that. It was called Circo. It was great. And then, I don't know what happened, but they're great. And so somehow we became really close. And the sax player ended up producing our first album. And then the singer also recorded on it. And it's just a relationship that we've had ever since.
Was there other bands that you were aware of that were mixing ska elements at that time? Or did it feel sort of like, other than you and Maldita, you guys were doing your own thing?
Café Tacuba was another one that was doing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, they definitely had some elements too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they changed throughout the years, which is great because they don't do the same thing over and over again. But those were one of the bands that we also played with a bunch in the beginning. Café Tacuba, Maldita Vecindad, and then a lot of Mano Negra. I don't know if you remember Mano Negra.
Yeah, yeah. But they're from France.
Yes, they're from France.
But they had a large audience in Mexico and Latin America.
Yeah, they kind of had a fascination, or Manu Chao did, with Latin America. So the first show that Mano Negra had in Mexico was in Tijuana. And that was because they were doing a tour in the U.S. and they wanted to play in Mexico. And the easiest thing was to play in Tijuana. And that's how we met them. So Manu ended up recording on our first album too, and our second one. But we met them at that show because, like, it was a show at this venue called Iguanas, which was a great venue back then. And there were like 20 people at the show. And we were blown away. We were like watching them and thinking, wow, this is amazing. And so we all met and became friends. And we ended up collaborating throughout the years and doing tours together, that sort of thing. But they were also very political. That was another band that I wanted to sort of sound like.
Do you know what year that was, this first show they did that they played in Mexico?
I want to say it was like maybe like 1991.
Yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, they didn't really take off in the U.S.
Yeah, no, they were so much about Latin America.
Yeah.
And they were very, at least Manu was very sort of anti-U.S. in some ways.
Sure, yeah.
And so I think they weren't that interested in, like, it's weird because he was not, I mean, I'm sure he wanted to do well, but he wasn't one to be like wanting to like play everywhere. It didn't seem like that, at least to us. Mm. He was just doing his thing. And now he's like living, I think he lives like between Barcelona and Argentina and just like plays with his guitar. Like, yeah, he just kind of did whatever he wanted to do, but he was great at it. So
yeah,
he did great, great stuff.
I was reading a little bit that you, and maybe this was just a normal thing, living in Tijuana, is would go to San Diego.
Yeah.
For shows, you know, is that just a thing that kids did back then, or I don't know, maybe they still do it?
Yeah, I mean, people still do it. Back then it was easier because crossing the border didn't take a million hours like it does now. So back then, I mean, everything changed after September 11th.
Sure.
Crossing the border became just like a nightmare. And it wasn't perfect, but it was fairly easy. So we would go often. And a lot of people that I knew, as long as you had a tourist visa, you would go and see shows. And it was great. And it was one thing that people in Mexico City didn't have at the time. Like, we were going to concerts all the time. And bands started coming to Mexico City years after. And it started with like really huge ones like Peter Gabriel and Madonna. But now, obviously, they have amazing festivals down there.
Yeah.
But that was a great thing for us because I feel like it really benefited us. And we learned so much from those experiences.
Yeah. I know it was a while ago, but what bands did you go see in San Diego?
I saw, my first band that I saw was General Public. Do you remember General Public?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We saw them. We saw Ziggy Marley. We saw, I saw Tin Machine. Do you remember Tin Machine?
Yeah.
What else did we saw? I mean, we saw a bunch. I don't remember, but it was kind of all over the place. It was great.
Would San Diego kids come to Tijuana to go to shows?
Once they opened this venue that I mentioned called Iguanas, they did. Because in this venue it was a great venue that didn't last that long. But I saw Sugar Cubes there, B-52s, Nirvana played there. I did not see them. Everybody came down to play those shows. And so people from San Diego would go. It was great. PIL, I saw PIL there too.
Nice.
It was fun.
So Julieta Venegas was in the band also in the early years.
Mm-hmm. We invited her so when we started playing, she had another band and that band dissolved. So we invited her to join us.
So you and her knew each other before the band, right? You guys were friends from high school?
Yes.
And you or the whole band, I guess, invited her to play in the band?
Yes. Yes.
Interesting. So she's currently a big pop star. I'm just for context, but she, how long was she in Tijuana No for?
She was less than a year with us, I think.
Less than a year. Okay.
Yeah. So it wasn't very long, but she wanted to do solo stuff and she's so meant to do that. Like I think the band dynamic was not her thing. So she started writing solo and having shows in Tijuana and I would play keyboards with her to sort of help her out when she was having little gigs. And then eventually she moved to Mexico City and she started her own thing over there.
Was she on the first record then, or did she leave before that? Or
she left before that. She never recorded with us.
So, okay. So you mentioned that the first record was released independently, and then BMG. What do you remember about the BMG signing?
I remember not a lot, but I remember the people that signed us were very excited, but it was like fake excitement. I think it was very, not that they weren't excited about the band, but it was just like, you know, label people, right? Sure. It can be very like, oh yes, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. So everything always felt like a little fake to me, but they seemed into it. And, I don't think we made a lot of money like with royalties and stuff, but it was great at the time because, you know, you had to have a label behind you so that people could know your music. And so that was a great thing.
I'm curious if they had any expectations or what they thought was going to be, you know, what like a plan for the bands, you know?
I think back then it was different because people were sort of betting on artist growth and career, you know?
Yeah.
So they didn't really expect the album necessarily to sell a ton, but their whole plan was like, and then we'll do a second one and hopefully that will reach more people. So I love that because that doesn't happen anymore. Like people just want to sign you if you're already viral or something.
Yeah,
sure.
So I did like that about them, that even though the sales were probably not great, they still were into us working more. So that was good. In the end, I would say it was a good experience. And it was something that helped us really reach people in a way that we wouldn't have been able to do just on our own.
We'll be right back after this.
The song on the first record, Pobre de Ti, was... you could probably say this is your best known song.
Yeah, it is for sure.
What do you remember about the writing and recording of the song?
So, the writing of it, I don't remember much about it because the drummer was basically working on the music on the bass. So I just remember coming in and out and just trying to like add stuff to it. And the recording, I remember we recorded that officially again when we signed with BMG. And I had a cold and it was like our last day of recording. So whenever I hear it, to me, my voice sounds very different because it sounds like, woo, yeah. Like, so it's kind of like deeper, which is weird. So that bummed me out because we couldn't redo it. So that bummed me out a little bit, but yeah, that's kind of what I remember. It was fun, but I felt rushed. I'm not going to lie. Yeah. I felt rushed.
I saw this thing online that said that, something called 50 by 50 Paseo del Rock Mexicano included it as one of the top 50 songs that defines, you know, rock in Mexico.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a pretty well-known, pretty important song, I guess you could say, in the sort of the history of using the term rock very, very generally, you know, in Mexico.
Yeah. No, it's funny because sometimes I still hear or see people respond to it. Like if I see people posting videos of like people dancing to it.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a different generation. Like younger people are still somehow connecting with it, which is bizarre, but it's also very flattering.
What happened at the time? Did it take off quickly, or is it sort of a slow kind of thing of that song really developing an audience?
I feel like it took off quickly. I really do, because when we recorded the video for it, we did a free show in like a plaza in Mexico City, in the downtown area, and it was packed. And people, you can see them dancing to it. And then that video was in rotation a lot on MTV Latin America. Mm. So that's how you reached other countries aside from Mexico. So yeah, I think it did well pretty quickly.
There's an interesting, there's some footage of Tijuana No performance at Vive Latino in 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're singing that song. And Julieta joins you partway through. And it's just, there's so many people and people are going crazy.
I know.
For that song, yeah.
It's crazy because, yeah, people, that was a great show, I have to say, because Julieta wrote lyrics for that song. Mm-hmm. This was before she left. And so we invited her to play. And I wasn't even part of the band anymore, but we just decided to get together for this performance. And I didn't really know what to expect, but people's response was just, it was crazy. It was very, yeah, it was overwhelming, but it was great. And I love being able to do it with her.
What, if you had to guess how many people were at that show, what would be your guess?
People say like around 80,000.
Damn.
Well,
because it's a crazy festival. And honestly, they do it really well. Like they have it down. But the amount of people that go to this festival is just, I was just there this March because I sang a song with a friend of mine that performed there. And it was just like insane the amount of people that go. So yeah, probably around that 80,000.
Was the, I don't know if you had played with the band since you left before then, or had you?
I don't remember if I had. Maybe I hadn't for a long time. I feel like I hadn't for a long time because it was a nice little reunion. And nowadays, whenever, if they're in town, I live in LA now, if they're in town playing a show and I'm free, I'll join them, like just to sing a couple of songs, or for special shows. If they want to do like a sort of like a closer thing to the original Tijuana, I'll join them because they're still playing. And now it's just like some other people are in the band, which yeah. is, I guess it's fine. But I try to join them whenever I can because it's always fun seeing them.
How has the band changed?
So, well, one of the singers died in almost 20 years ago.
Yeah. Talking about Luis.
Luis Guareña.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then now the other singer left the band too, like a year ago or something. So now originals are only the drummer and the guitar player and a sax player. But other than that, it's a bunch of people. So like when they played a show here last year and they wanted me to join them. And so I went to a rehearsal and I was just like, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Like I didn't know anybody. So that was weird. I was like, okay. But you know, in the beginning, I was like, why are they still playing? But then I thought, you know, the songs are as much mine as theirs, and they should have the right to perform them if they want to.
Yeah. And musically, is it the same?
Yeah, it's the same. Well, the thing is that they haven't released an album since the last time we did.
Oh, wow.
Which was like, yeah. So yeah, it's basically the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they're recording now or they're trying to they've been trying to record, but I don't know how far they've gone on that.
Yeah.
I saw Tijuana No in 2019 at a ska festival in Oaxaca called Scatlón. You weren't there, I don't think, right? Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I was surprised. Actually, I didn't realize that they were still playing. So it kind of blew me away that they were on the festival.
Yeah. No. And I'm like, wow, they got a lot of shows all the time. I'm like, how are they doing that? So I'm like, here is a solo artist struggling to get shows, and they've got shows with like records from the 90s. Well, you know, people connect to it and they still want to see them. So good for them.
So the second record, Transgresores de la Ley, you're in that record too, right?
Yeah. I'm on all three records. Yeah.
Oh, you are on all three. Okay.
Yeah, that one was a great experience because that one was produced by a friend of ours, Fermín Muguruza, who used to be in a punk band from the Basque Country. And he's been a friend of ours for a very, very long time. And so we went to the Basque Country and recorded over there at a studio that he was working at. And it was great because during that stay, Mano Negra was doing a little tour in the Basque Country. So they came through and they recorded, or Manu recorded some songs with us. And then we ended up doing some shows with them over there. Mm. So yeah, that was a great time.
Now the Zapatistas movement is underway at this point. And it's my understanding that the record is either dedicated to, or kind of in reference to their cause.
Yeah, it was dedicated. Absolutely. Because for us and a lot of people in 1994, which was a very important year, it was very inspiring to see a movement like that, you know, actually demanding change in our country, which hadn't happened in a long time, especially from an indigenous community. Mm-hmm. We'd never seen that before. So that, I think, it it gave everybody hope that things could get better. So it was very inspiring for us and for a lot of people.
Is it possible to kind of explain in a very, like, you know, for people who aren't really familiar with this history, like what the significance of the Zapatista movement was?
Yeah. Well, indigenous communities in Mexico are very sort of forgotten by governments. A lot of the times they sometimes lack access to schools. A lot of them live in extreme poverty. And so the Zapatista movement started in 1994, and they were demanding their land, you know, to have access to education, all these things that I just mentioned, among others. And so on January 1st of 1994 is when they sort of showed the world their movement, what they were about and what they were planning on doing, what they were expecting the government to do for them and for all of the other communities in Mexico. So it was, and the leader at the time was a very charismatic man who was very smart. And so he captured people's like attention immediately. And it became just a movement that inspired not just Mexicans, but people all over the world were very passionate about this particular movement and about him. And so a lot of bands sort of rallied and tried to help this community in particular and do shows and benefiting them and sending food, sending generators, et cetera. It was a time where it felt like things were going to change, and it was great. It was very, we were all sort of united, which was amazing.
Yeah, I know a lot of the bands and a lot of, particularly in the ska scene in Mexico, were quite involved with this. And I think Maldita Vecindad were pretty heavily involved, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I feel like everybody was. It feels like them, Café Tacuba too, or at least the singer. Mm-hmm. The singer was very involved. There were other bands that were just having events in Mexico City to gather money or whatever they needed to do to send over to Chiapas in particular.
Could you define like what they were specifically asking for?
Well, there's a lot of crime that was happening against indigenous people by the army in Mexico too. So there was that, and then there was the lack of safety, the lack of education, lack of food, land taken from them. So they wanted to be independent from the government and have their own communities that were sort of governed by themselves. You know, like they create their own, and it did happen to a certain degree. And I'm not aware of the specifics right now of how things are down there, but yeah, basically they wanted to create their own community where their own needs were satisfied, which were different. They were explaining the differences with living as an indigenous person in a rural community. Like the needs are going to be different from somebody who lives in Mexico City, for example.
I see. Okay.
Among other things, I'm just like.
Yeah. Yeah. Just generally. Okay.
Yeah.
And so Tijuana No, and I think Luis in particular, if I understand correctly, were involved not just in fundraisers for this movement, but other causes at the time as well, right?
Yeah, yeah, because Luis was very, before he started with us, he would promote, be a promoter. Mm-hmm. So he would bring bands from San Diego to play in Tijuana. And then we ended up putting on events that would benefit either migrant communities or an organization in Tijuana called Casa del Migrante that supported migrants who got to the border and didn't have anywhere to sleep. So we did shows benefiting them. There's another place called Casa de los Pobres. So we did events for them too. We did events for El Salvador. We did a bunch of stuff in support of different causes.
I mean, this is what bands should do. So I think it's interesting that sometimes when this gets discussed and it's almost like an anomaly, but this is what bands should be doing.
I agree. Because it's not even, it doesn't take a lot from you. Do you know what I'm saying? Like it was just, it would say pay your ticket and bring two cans of something or a bag of rice.
Yeah.
And then we would separate everything. And then the next day things would be donated. And it was, a lot of help to these places that were doing great work with very little support.
The first song on the record, Golpes Bajos,
mm-hmm.
I'm curious about what's kind of went behind, what's the inspiration of that song. It has a lot of force, it's a fierce song.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the lyrics. I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, it was just about resilience and just like overcoming.
Yeah.
And even though people might try to, like kick you or put you down, that you should be able to get up and continue doing what you're passionate about. I think that's kind of like the general idea.
I was curious though, because it's the opening track and, you know, you dedicated the album to the Zapatista movement. I was wondering if it was related to that or if it was just sort of a general like feeling, you know.
I think it was more of a general feeling, but overall I think in the album there's a little bit of a connection. You end up finding a connection to what inspired the record.
And so you guys covered Spanish Bombs by The Clash on the record. Okay, so as I understand the original, the meaning behind the original that The Clash wrote had to do with the ETA bombings that were happening in Costa Bravo, which I also think he was thinking about the IRA and the UK and stuff. So this is kind of what Joe Strummer is going on in Joe Strummer's head. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what about the song you connected to and why you wanted to perform the song on the record.
So it's not that interesting of a story. We liked the song. And so we were, when we were trying to, there's like this great explanation. But we were rehearsing to record our second album. And Fermin, who's the guy that ended up producing this album, came to Tijuana and we would rehearse that song because we liked it. And we were just like, oh, let's just play Spanish Bombs. And I was saying it. And then he was like, you should record it. And we were like, what? Because we'd never really recorded covers before. And he was like, you have to. So it was basically because he insisted that it was a good idea. And we also wanted a song where I was singing. Because there weren't that many. And then we recorded in the Basque Country. And it is also about Franco and bombs in Guernica. And so it just sort of made sense.
Yeah, it made sense.
In a very sort of organic way. But it wasn't like, let's think about the cover. Like, we didn't think about it that way.
Okay. I mean, I mean, it makes sense. But at the same time, I thought it could have been like a very meaningful song too, just because of the context of the original and
yeah, I think it ended up working out without us really thinking about it too much.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now there's this I found this clip in 2013 of you performing the song on, I don't know what it was, PBS, KCET or something.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember. It's like kind of slow and it's pretty stripped down.
And I performed that? God, I don't remember that.
It was you. It wasn't Tijuana No, it was you. It was you in your name.
Okay. Maybe. I mean, because I did play that as a solo artist sometimes.
It's very different than the Tijuana No version.
Yeah. Because I was very wanting to be away from the ska sound.
Yeah.
Because I just wanted to try, wanting to try something different for a while. And so sometimes if I would play it, I try to experiment a little bit with it. So I believe you, but I just don't remember.
Okay,
I don't remember much about that. But yes, I believe it.
It's. I was just curious about the musical choices because it was very interesting musical choices in that version that you did.
Yeah, I also think that people, thankfully, really connected to this version of Spanish Bombs and the one that we did with Tijuana No.
Yeah.
And so sometimes people would ask me to play stuff. And I would normally not want to because I had this thing about separating myself from what I did with them and wanting to have people see what I was doing now as something separate. But then I thought, you know, I like the song. I have no problem with it. I love it. And so my guess is that that's probably why I did it.
Where are you with that now? That separation between what you did and what you are doing now?
I'm doing really well with it because I think it took a while for me to sort of appreciate what we did in the past.
Yeah.
And I think I was just trying to show people that I was something very different from that, because you know, the truth is a lot of years have passed.
Yeah.
So at first I was like, no, I want people to think of me as some new artist that has nothing to do with that. But then I realized, you know, I'm proud of the work that we did. Obviously I would do some things differently, but I'm sure everybody says the same thing.
Sure.
But overall, I'm proud with the work that we did, and I love my band, my former bandmates. And, so yeah, I'm okay with it. Like I'm proud of it. So, yeah.
Hell yeah.
I'm not going to like play the music in my shows, but I'm totally happy to talk about it. Cause I feel like, I think it took many years for me to appreciate the work that we did. Like really like realize that some of the stuff that we did was really cool and was really different and important. And, it took me many, many years to realize it.
I would imagine too, how young you were during the band's run, that there would be some attachment to that being part of your very, you know, young or your childhood to some degree, and to, you know, young adulthood, that when you're older, it's hard to connect with that as much as being part of who you are as an adult.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that once I left the band, I wanted to see if there was something else that I wanted to do. Cause I was like, I just started doing this and I never gave myself the chance to explore anything else. So I ended up exploring a little bit more and then I ended up coming back to music. But it was definitely, it has to do with that. I think I was very young and I did feel like it was just a different era, but I'm fine with it now.
So you played on the third record.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
So you weren't in the band at the time?
No, I was for the you third were, record. Contra Revolución. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not sure if you have insight into this, but this is something that I remember at the time and I've thought about and been wondering about. As somebody who was living in the US and was very into ska in the 90s, there was a conscious effort for Tijuana No to crack into the US punk and ska market of the late 90s. Mm-hmm. I saw it happen and I got the record. I was a fan, but I saw that it didn't really land the way other bands did. But I did not see any of the other bands from Mexico make that attempt to really get into this ska punk boom happening in the US. It was just Tijuana No from my point of view.
I mean, I think that the reason has to do more with geography, because we were so close to LA, for example, or Orange County. Mm-hmm. And it was easy enough for us to come, whereas somebody from Mexico City would have to take a plane. Then you have to talk about work visas that we never got. Like we would just cross the border and say we're going to play for free somewhere. And so that made it so much easier for us. But it was also just a good market. I mean, in the end, yeah, maybe. I mean, we connected obviously mostly with Latino people here. But if some people that were non-Latino connected with it, we were more than happy, because in the end, yes, you do want to reach as many people as you can. But you're right. It was never like we didn't really tour with bands here that much. And we did some shows opening for like Rage Against the Machine, which was a little bit different.
Yeah.
We're moving away from ska altogether. But yes, you're correct.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
While the band was playing, while you were living in Tijuana, immigration was an issue that was, you know, kind of in your guys' head and stuff you were talking about. And then you know, eventually you moved to LA, and I think that you probably had that issue kind of in your head, but, you know, a different perspective to some degree, or maybe an added perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, like, What was your thoughts and feelings in the 90s while still in Tijuana No about what was going on with immigration and concerns you had about immigration, you know, people trying to get into the US, and what the attitudes were at the time?
Yeah, I think when I was in Tijuana, well, and I tell the story often, but you grow up in a city like that and you're seeing people try to cross the border on a daily basis, really. Mm-hmm. And when you're super young, you don't really understand what's happening. And then you realize that that Mexico is, you know, there's a lot of poverty and there's a huge gap in wealth, and people are in need of a better life, as cliche as that might sound.
Sure.
But so I understood the need to cross the border and try to live here. But once I moved here, I saw the obstacles that people face here. And especially if you're not documented, like the fear of being deported, the fear that increases every time you hear somebody like Trump saying he's going to deport 11 million people, mm-hmm. you know, and then when you see videos of a parent taking a child to school and then taken by immigration officers and being deported, it's just heartbreaking. Like, it's beyond heartbreaking. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do something more. Like, I felt that like I wasn't, yeah, I was talking about things, and then I was performing sometimes at events that benefited people who were undocumented, but I felt like I wasn't doing enough. And so that's when I started doing this training to become a child advocate. And that made me feel like I was actually helping in a way that felt very small, because it's just like one kid at the time. But then it just felt like I was achieving more somehow. But yes, I think it added a different perspective once I moved to this country, for sure.
Yeah, some of the stuff that I learned as an adult, you know, especially because I worked in restaurants for a good chunk of years, and there's a lot of people who are immigrants, some documented, some not documented, is that for the most part, I mean, you can't really generalize, but yeah, a lot of people who are here undocumented, they don't want to have attention drawn to them. They want to mm-hmm. live their life, contribute, help their family. So like all this fear is unfounded for that reason alone. It's they're not even thinking about the intention of why they're here to begin with and why they're not going to be out there, you know, destroying things or whatever, because they want to stay here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then the other thing I learned, and this was while I was working at a restaurant, is that it's not just one. There are people from various classes in Mexico that come to this country for opportunity. Like I had some friends that I worked with at Denny's that were waiters, and they were, you know, went to college. I guess you could say they were probably like middle class, but they had mm-hmm. no opportunity. Mm-hmm. And they came to this country. They were undocumented, and they came here and had for opportunities. And, you know, it's not like one kind of person that's affected that is trying to build a better life for themselves and for their family. And I think that you kind of are told that it's like one class in a sense, but it's not.
No, when I first came here, I first moved to LA back in like 2000. I lived here for about a year, and I was undocumented, basically. I had my tourist visa. But every time I'd see a cop driving, I would worry. And I got pulled over once. And so I tell the story. I'm just visiting and I have my visa. And that's why I mentioned in the beginning, I'm in a very different situation, because I'm very privileged to have that and say, I'm just visiting and I'm going to go back home. But there was always a little bit of fear, even though I had a document. So I could only imagine what it would be like to be driving the freeways to go work somewhere, and then the fear of being stopped and questioned. So that's another reason why I felt more connected to these stories of people that come here. Like you say, there's all kinds of people. And generally are people that are working really hard. And like you said, try not to get a lot of attention for the same reason, but they're just here with a purpose. And it's impressive. Honestly, I find it very impressive.
So I want to ask about after Tijuana No, you play with Julieta for a little bit, for what, like from like 2000 to 2008?
Yes, correct.
Okay. I'm a big fan. I think she's amazing.
She is. I'm a fan too.
This period that you play with her, that's kind of like her breakout period too, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was living in LA and I started playing with her, but she wasn't having a lot of shows because it was just like, she was not as famous as she became. And then once she started getting more well-known, she said, do you want to move to Mexico City? Because that's where everybody is. And honestly, when I was living here in LA without documents and working this job that was awful with this woman that sold purses that were like really ugly purses, and she was kind of a bully to us. I was basically getting the check from her and paying rent, and that was it. And I was like, what the hell am I doing here? And so when she offered that, I moved to Mexico City for 5 years and I just played with her. And that was great. It was connected back to music in a way that was almost more free because I wasn't dealing with anything. I was just playing. So that was fun for many years until I started wanting to write my own stuff.
Sure. Is it her 2003 record C? Is that when she really blows up?
Yeah. Yes. That's the one.
Yeah. What was that like? Like when you say blow up, like what did she went from what to what?
So she went, I remember when she showed me the songs for that album.
Yeah.
Cause she had gone to record in Spain with a songwriter over there and she showed me the songs and they sounded so different to me. Like she kept saying, I'm tired of making songs that are too complicated. I want people to sing along to my songs. And I listened to it and I was like, oh my God, there were like so many harmonies and so many, it just sounded so different to me. And I was at first, I mean, I liked it, but I was like, this is very strange. But then obviously people connected to it and she was right. People sang along with it and they still do. So that was just like the beginning of her just becoming the artist that she became.
Andar Conmigo, is that the first big
hit? Yes.
That's my song.
And it's huge. Whenever she plays it, it's just like, yeah, people go crazy.
Have you heard Oso Motley's cover of that song?
I feel like I did a long time ago.
It's a reggae version.
Yes, I think so. I think
somebody out of the band sings it, I think. They did that record a little while ago called Nonstop Mexico to Jamaica. So it's all songs that are from Mexico or popular amongst Latinos in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And they turned them into reggae songs.
Oh, God, no. I didn't know.
Yeah, that's one of the songs on there.
Yeah, people love that song.
Yeah. But I feel like, was it the next record, Me Boy, that's like the big, big song, right?
Yeah. I think they're both are equally big. But she became something of like a household name almost because she also did like a bunch of things that at the moment I thought were very strange. Like Pepsi commercials, for example.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? And then she ended up being sick of it because she was like, it became people knew her because of the commercials, because of TV. And then she wanted to kind of step away a little bit from that. But the combination of this song, Andar Conmigo, Pepsi commercial, and then the label obviously being very happy with her, starting to push her music way more after that success of Andar Conmigo. And then once she started not being as successful, they quickly were like, okay, that's it. Just how labels are. They're like, we're not going to help you much more. It's pretty brutal.
Well, what size shows were you playing? Was she playing when you were in that band during this time as these songs were blowing up?
I think maybe like, 2,000, 3,000, something like that. It wasn't like massive, massive.
Okay.
Once I left, I guess some of them were very big. Depends on where we were. Mm-hmm. But we did some festivals that were huge. We did one in Buenos Aires that was quite large. We did all kinds. We did all kinds of shows.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
So was there anything specific that led to you wanting to choose a solo career at this point? So you've done Tijuana No, you'd played with Julieta for a while, and then you decide, you want to be a solo artist. You want to be your own artist.
Yeah, I think I got a little tired, but not in a bad way, of just playing other people's music.
Yeah.
And I think I learned a lot from Julieta, and I always say this as a band leader, because I think she is very good at it. She knows what she wants and what she doesn't want, and she's very clear. So that was great. And also, like, when you play somebody else's music, you sort of understand how people approach writing music. So you always learn from it. And so that was great. But I did want to start writing. And I started writing while I was playing with her. And then I released an EP. And then I just started getting some offers to play and do other stuff. And it was sort of getting very difficult because her schedule was so busy. So I started talking to her about maybe leaving the band, and she was great. She was like, I totally understand. Why don't we start by you doing North America, Mexico, blah, blah, and we have somebody else in South America. And then little by little, I started doing less and less. We did the MTV Unplugged, which was technically my last gig with her.
Oh, was it?
So yeah, so that was a great way to end. And then she did a tour with them with, you know, for that specific record. And I wasn't part of that tour anymore. But it was a fun way to end it. I felt very proud of that. Yeah.
Interesting. So you've primarily been a solo independent artist from that point to the present that we're in right now.
Yes.
And to kind of touch back on what we talked about earlier, so it's somewhat been through this process that you've been able to reflect on the legacy of Tijuana No and your prior stuff, having been doing your solo stuff and kind of being separate from it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate my stuff with Tijuana No. I appreciate when I listen to that MTV Unplugged of Julietas, I appreciate the work that we did for that, because that was a lot of work. So yeah, it's been, I feel very fortunate that I was able to be part of both things.
Do you have any thoughts about what your specific legacy or what Tijuana No's specific legacy is in the greater scheme of things?
I think we were one of the first or few bands that were really talking about political things in a very direct way. And we were very passionate about it. So I think that might be one of the things. And the other thing is that back then there weren't a lot of women in music, at least not in rock music. There were a few, but it was mainly guys everywhere. And so that was also cool to be a young person and all of a sudden, you know, in a band that became fairly important. So I think that's what I would focus more on.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Okay, what are you still doing here? You didn't want to have to turn off the podcast, did you? Well, this is the end of the show, but it doesn't have to be. Listen, we have a Patreon. You can head right over there. Aaron's going to tell you all about it on your way over. Hit it, Aaron.
All right, so check this out. In Defense of Ska Patreon, you get extended interviews. You don't have to feel sad that the episode is over right this second. You can listen to more episode, and you will feel so much happier.
So much happier. So listen, much happier. You'll be supporting this show. You'll be helping us to make it. And we thank you so much for your help. Ska now, more than ever.